Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, presenting the major news articles from the Monday, June 15th, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's check out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, thunderstorms during the morning hours, then skies turning partly cloudy during the afternoon. Highs to 102 degrees Fahrenheit. Winds northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Chance of rain, 90%. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies, lows to 78 degrees Fahrenheit. Winds west at 10 to 20 miles per hour, becoming south, southeast, and decreasing to less than 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sunny, highs to 103 degrees Fahrenheit. Winds west-northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. And now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, the first article is titled, Iran Questions U.S. Peace Commitment. This article was written by Mohammed Al-Welly, and Phil Stewart, all of Reuters. Iran's top negotiator questioned the United States' commitment to peace efforts after Israel carried out new attacks on Lebanon, dimming prospects of Tehran and Washington signing a framework agreement on Sunday on ending their war. U.S. President Donald Trump and mediator of Pakistan said on Saturday they expected the deal would be signed on Sunday, but Tehran cast doubt over the timing and hardline protesters in Iran voiced opposition. Qatari negotiators flew to Tehran on Sunday morning as part of an effort to finalize the agreement, a source with knowledge of the situation told Reuters. But Iranian negotiator Mohammad Bakir Qalibaf said Israel's attack on Sunday on the southern suburbs of Beirut, which Israel said targeted the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants, showed the U.S. backed the will or ability to fulfill its commitments. If you lack the will and ability to fulfill your commitments, speaking of continuing the path is not possible, he wrote on X, in an apparent reference to peace moves. Mohammad Jafar Asadi, the deputy commander of Iran's top joint military command, was quoted by state media as saying Israeli crimes in Beirut's seven southern suburbs would not go unanswered. The U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, launched on February 28th, has stoked conflict between Israel and Iran-aligned Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Israel has said it is not party to the planned U.S.-Iran deal. The Israeli military said on Sunday that Hezbollah had launched three projectiles towards communities in northern Israel in violation of a ceasefire in Lebanon. Israel then fired at what it called Hezbollah targets in the Dahi neighborhood of Beirut in an attack the Lebanon civil defense said killed three people. Fox News quoted an unidentified diplomat involved in the talks as saying the Israeli strikes were complicating efforts to finalize the U.S.-Iran deal and describing them as an attempt to sabotage these efforts. Israel did not immediately respond to the assertion. Israel has said it will retain freedom of operations in Lebanon, while Tehran has made a full ceasefire there an important component of its demand. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also clashed with Trump over U.S. demands that Israel curb military action in Lebanon to allow Washington to reach a deal with Tehran. Thousands of people have been killed, and mostly in Iran and Lebanon, since the U.S. and Israel began strikes on Iran. Iran has struck Israel and Gulf states that host U.S. bases and has effectively blockaded the Strait of Hormuz, a vital artery for global oil supplies. The blockade has pushed up global energy prices, while the U.S. Navy has blocked Iranian ports. Trump posted on Saturday that the deal with Iran was scheduled to be signed on Sunday, his 80th birthday. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said Islamabad was preparing for an electronic signing to be followed by technical-level talks in the coming weeks. But Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghaei, speaking before Trump's post, was quoted by state media as saying it would not be on Sunday, although it could happen in the coming days. Iran's Fars news agency, citing an informed source, said on Sunday, Tehran has not yet taken a final decision on a framework agreement, with reviews of its political, legal, and technical aspects ongoing at expert and decision-making levels. A senior Iranian official told Reuters that under the terms of the draft deal, the U.S. would agree to release $25 billion of frozen Iranian assets, while Tehran would agree not to produce or acquire nuclear weapons. Trump wrote on Truth Social that after a framework deal is signed, the Strait of Hormuz would immediately be open to all. Once the strait reopens, the U.S. would lift its naval blockade, sources on all sides said. Negotiations over Iran's nuclear program would take place afterwards. While U.S. and Israeli bombing has heavily degraded Iran's military, industrial base, and damaged its military, experts say the war has entrenched the dominance of Iran's hardline Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. When the U.S. and Israel launched the war, Trump called on Iranians to rise up and take over state institutions. Even as the U.S. and Iran appear to be moving towards an agreement over the past few days, clashes have continued. At pro-government rallies across Iran on Saturday night, residents and news agencies reported that hardliners opposed to the framework agreement loudly voiced their dissatisfaction. A resident in the northeastern city of Mashhad told Reuters that some protesters chanted death to the compromiser in an apparent reference to Iraqi and compromiser resign. Draft terms of the agreement described by Reuters by multiple sources indicate the U.S. would begin releasing frozen Iranian assets and waive sanctions on its oil exports in return for Iran opening the strait. Iran's nuclear program would be addressed during a 60-day period of talks. A senior Iranian official told Reuters on Sunday that Iran agreed to maintain the nuclear status quo, including no uranium enrichment or expanding nuclear facilities, until a final deal was reached. The next article is titled, Arizona Voters to Decide 10 Measures. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Arizonans will be asked in November to decide who can participate in girls' sports, what identification people need to vote, and whether to ban DEI-type programs. In a series of last-minute decisions, the Republican-controlled legislature gave final approval to the most controversial measures before adjourning for the year Saturday morning. Some are amendments to the Arizona Constitution, which can be enacted only with voter approval, but others are being put on the ballot to avoid possible vetoes by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs, who gets the last word on statutory changes, but not on ballot measures. In total, Republicans in the legislature referred 10 measures to voters. And there may be 3 more proposals on the ballot, all dependent on whether their citizen sponsors can get the required signature. Here is a quick analysis of what's coming. Subject: voting rules. This measure would put language into the Arizona Constitution to say that only citizens can vote and that foreign nationals cannot spend money to influence Arizona elections. But all that already is the law in Arizona, said Tempe Democrat Senator Mitzi Epstein. She said the measure is designed to bury the fact that a key provision could make it harder, if not impossible, for people to cast their ballot by mail, a practice that for years has been used by more than 80% of voters statewide. The applicable language spells out that ID must be presented in each election, whether voting in person or by any other method. That's how the system works now for those who vote in person, but it's not the case for mail voting. Instead, voters must sign the ballot envelope. then the law requires that signature to be compared with that voter signature that election officials have on file. Whether from when people first signed up to vote or from other documents, including prior early ballots. Representative John Gillette said the mandate is justified. The Kingman Republican said polls show that more than 80% of Americans support voter ID. "This is what my constituents want," added Representative Lisa Fink, Republican of Glendale. But Phoenix Democratic Representative Stacey Travis said, "What's missing is exactly how that would work for mail-in ballots. That is left to a future legislature to decide," he said. Scottsdale Republican Representative Alexander Kalodin said, "There are options." For example, he said county election officials could issue each registered voter a unique identification number. Then they would have to put at least the last four digits of that number on the ballot envelope. Representative Lydia Hernandez, Democrat of Phoenix, worried that the yet-to-be-determined system could be more complicated, as in requiring people to make copies of identification documents and send them in with their ballots. "That doesn't help those who don't have easy access to a copier," she said. The bigger fear among some Democrats is that the Republican-controlled legislature, echoing the will of President Donald Trump, who has called for an end to all early voting, would instead enact a law to require people to show up in person at the polls with their ballots and IDs, effectively ending all early voting. Representative Rachel Keschel, a Republican of Tucson, said adding that identification to the Arizona Constitution will instill trust in our elections. But Tucson Democratic Representative Elmer Hernandez wondered exactly why Republicans think elections have been affected by people voting who should not. "You all still won," she said, pointing out that Republicans outnumber Democrats in the House and Senate, so I don't know what election was stolen. Of note is that there a separate initiative derived that would put a provision into the Arizona Constitution guaranteeing the right to vote by mail? Backers need 383,923 valid signatures on petitions by July 2nd to put that plan on the November ballot. If both were to pass, the measure that got more votes would take precedence if the court conclude any provisions are in conflict. Next subject, girls' sports. Also on the ballot is the hot-button issue of who can play in girls' sports. The debate revolves around transgender females, those assigned as male based on their biological features at birth but who identify themselves as females. It is not fair to allow biological males to compete in competitive sports against biological females, said Senate Majority Leader John Kavanaugh. The Fountain Hills Republicans said they are inherently stronger than girls of their own age, having God-given testosterone that results in more muscle mass. But others argue that isn't necessarily true, particularly among transgender girls who have gone through puberty, or rather who have not gone through puberty. Senator Annalise Ortiz proposed to alter the measure to allow a sponsoring athletic association to make rules to determine who can participate in certain sports based not on gender but on other factors relevant to the sport, including age, essentially to determine whether one's sex would have an inherent advantage. The Phoenix Democrats said that would take care of situations of transgender children who identify with gender different from the one they were assigned at birth and who want to play sports with other girls. But that was rejected by the Republicans. Arizona already has a voter-approved law that spells out that terms, that teams designed for women or girls may not be open to students of the male sex. This measure rewords some of that and adds some new definitions and restrictions, including listing who can use which locker room based on sex. It also defines sex to mean the individual's biological status as male or female as recorded at birth on the individual's original birth certificate. That would get around the court ruling that says the state must issue amended birth certificates to transgender individuals. It also is unclear whether any of this would overturn the ruling of a federal judge who has allowed two transgender girls to participate in girls' sports. The judge said the Arizona law cannot be applied to them because there was evidence on plaintiffs either had not entered puberty or were given puberty blockers, meaning they had no more inherent strength than boys of the same age. That ruling was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but the last word could depend on how the U.S. Supreme Court rules on similar claims out of Idaho and West Virginia. Next subject, photo radar. Foes of photo radar have been trying to get it outlawed for years, but they run into opposition from local officials who say the use of cameras makes their streets safer. The counter from Foes is that the cities are really interested in revenues generated with speeding tickets, often drawing fines in excess of $200. This ballot measure gives voters in each of those communities a voice. If approved, no community could install a new photo enforcement system unless local officials first got approval from voters in a local ballot measure. Existing communities could keep their cameras, but those contracts would expire every 10 years unless there was a new public vote. Part of the reason this is going to the ballot is because Hobbs has vetoed other proposals to limit photo enforcement. The legislature separately approved a bill, one not contingent on voter approval, to cap the fines for photo radar violators at $75. The state could not forward information about citations to insurance companies, and the citations could not be used to suspend anyone's license. Lawmakers did carve out exceptions, though, for citations for criminal speeding, meaning more than 20 miles over the posted limit, as well as for speeding through school crossings and for running a red light. Next subject, classroom spending. The Arizona Auditor General's Office produces an annual report of how much of each dollar every school district gets goes to instructional expenses. That mainly involves salaries and benefits for teachers, aides, and substitutes, plus general instruction supplies, field trips, and athletics. Representative Matt Kress pointed out that the most recent report shows that on average, schools in Arizona spend just 52.1 cents of every dollar on instruction. That's the lowest figure in two decades that such reports have been prepared. So the Phoenix Republican got a measure added to the ballot to require each district to get that figure up to at least 60%. He said that would force schools to put more dollars into teacher salaries. Foes said the problem with a hard and fast formula is it does not account for districts that have higher than average costs, like geographically large districts with transportation costs. And it comes at a time when the state's major utilities are looking to impose increases in the price of electricity. But Gress insisted that some costs can be reduced. He said some districts have higher utility costs because they are not closing schools despite declining enrollment resulting in high utility costs. The measure would require any district below that 60% level to improve instructional spending by at least a half percentage point a year. Gress said that's not an unreasonable ask. So, for example, Glendale Elementary School District, which the report showed put 49%, or rather 49.8 cents of every dollar into instruction and would have more than 20 years to comply. The teeth in the measure is that those who don't make progress would lose some of their state funds, though there is an option for the state superintendent of public instructions to issue up to two waivers every decade. The 60% mandate also would apply only for schools, school districts in Pima, Pinal, or Maricopa County, and for districts of at least 7,500 students in the other 12 counties. Next topic, diversity and discrimination. Also going to the ballot is a measure proponents said is designed to tighten up existing laws to prevent preferential treatment based on race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in public employment, education, or contracting. House Speaker Steve Montenegro noted that Arizona voters approved a measure in 2010 to ban racial discrimination in public employment, education, and contracts. But the Goodyear Republican said there have been efforts to find loopholes to advance practices and programs and end up classifying individual students based on their race or their skin color. I think we can all agree that it's never, never okay to discriminate based on race or sex or ethnicity, he said. The measure seeks to add new provisions like barring spending public money to operate any office in public education that is responsible for promoting preferential treatment. Also forbidden would be using race or ethnicity as a factor in admission, graduation, hiring, promotion, certification, or any employment function or scholarship opportunity. It also would outlaw any training of public employees about the concept of diversity, equity, and inclusion. It also takes aim at what proponents say are questions asked of job applicants about DEI, a move they say lets agencies screen out certain people. But Senate Minority Leader Prayer Sundaresan said the net effect would be broader. The Tucson Democrat spoke of going to law school at the University of Arizona and getting support by being a member of the Women's Lawyers Association and the Asian Pacific American Law Students Association. She said those organizations helped members complete their education, saying they could reach out to each other. Sundaresan said she believes those kinds of organizations would be banned. Senator Sally Ann Gonzalez, Democrat of Tucson, said she feared broader implications, saying it would prohibit teaching the history of my people. Next topic, vehicle taxes. Arizonans will get the chance to decide whether to outlaw a method being considered to make sure owners of electric vehicles pay their fair share of the costs of building and maintaining roads. Such construction now is funded largely by the state's 18 cents a gallon gasoline tax, but there is no equivalent levy against those who charge up their vehicles by plugging them in. One idea is to have a tax based on the number of miles racked up each year by an electrical vehicle. There have been various proposals to come up with an equivalency formula. All have been defeated. This measure would put a provision into the Arizona Constitution barring state and local governments from imposing any tax or fee based on the vehicle miles traveled. Senator Jake Hoffman is framing the issue as not one of finance, but of privacy. It stands on the very simple principle that government should not be tracking or taxing your miles, said the Queen Creek Republican. The Arizona Department of Transportation noting the increasing trend away from gasoline has contracted for a study to put a number of how many electric vehicles are driving in the state and how that figure might change in the future. That study also will help ADOT determine how the shift will affect fuel usage tax receipts. Next topic, food taxes. The ability of local communities to impose their sales taxes on food would be constrained if voters approve another ballot measure. Arizona does not have a tax food, or rather, Arizona does not tax food. But that option still remains for cities, many of whom say they are dependent on the revenues generated. What Representative Leo Biasucci crafted is a compromise of sorts. If approved in November, the measure would be by the lake. Havasu City Republican would spell out that beginning on July 1, 2027, the sale of food items intended for human consumption could not be taxed. But it says cities that have such levy could keep them with certain restrictions. If the tax is 2% or more, it could remain but could not be increased. Communities with a tax rate lower than that could go up to the 2% figure, but only if they first got approval from local voters. The same rule would apply to any city or town with no sales tax now on food that wants to impose one. In all cases, any increase in the food tax will be prohibited if the community increased any other sales, use, or other taxes after July 1, 2027. Next topic, terrorist organizations. Voters will decide whether to designate drug cartels as terrorist organizations. There's more to that issue than a name. The measure drafted by Montenegro, the Republican House Speaker, also would require the Arizona Department of Homeland Security to do everything within its authority to address the threat posed by drug cartels. It defines those as any organizations, formal or otherwise, engaged in human smuggling, drug trafficking for profit, or any act of terrorism. Montenegro said the measure follows vote of approval in 2024 of Proposition 314, a measure that allows state and local police to arrest people who enter the country at other than a port of entry. That law has yet to take effect. It was modeled after SB 4, a similar law in Texas that has been subject to court challenge over whether it illegally interferes with the right of the federal government to control immigration. Rather than draw another fight, Proposition 314 said it would take effect only if that Texas law ultimately is determined to be constitutional. A federal appeals court has upheld the Texas law, but that is not the last word, with the issue not pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Next topic, voucher protection. Lawmakers also want voters to put a provision in the Arizona Constitution that would overrule any new restrictions enacted by voters on school vouchers. On paper, it would provide some protection for children of military personnel to get vouchers of state dollars to go to private or parochial schools or for some homeschooling. It spells out that no future initiative would take away dollars that these children have not spent at the end of any school year, cementing into the Constitution the existing practice that allows voucher dollars to be carried forward year after year. That language, however, is a direct response to a proposed citizens' initiative for the ballot measure that could curb the vouchers, known as empowerment scholarship accounts. One of the changes would bar any recipients from banking those unused dollars, some of whom save their annual allocations for college. But the measure GOP lawmakers put on the ballot also contains a provision designed to kill an entire voucher reform initiative being pushed by the Arizona Education Association and Save Our Schools. It says that if any future measure is approved that would take unused funds from military children, that entire initiative and all its restrictions would be declared void, not just the part about leftover dollars. Backers of the legislative measure made no secret of their motive. It was crafted only after a proposed deal fell apart between the Republican legislative leaders and the AEA to drop the organization's comprehensive voucher reform proposal, one with strict limits on the use of voucher dollars and an income limit on recipients. "This is a scam," said Representative Alma Hernandez. The Tucson Democrat said it shows the Republicans who control the legislature know that voters support the AEA initiative and are doing whatever they can to make sure it never takes effect. While the legislative vote sends the voucher protection measure to voters, backers of the AEA/SOS measure have until July 2nd to gather the necessary 255,949 signatures to put their voucher plan on the November ballot. There also is a separate petition drive by Fortify AZ to revamp rules on vouchers. It lacks one key thing in the proposal backed by education groups, a cap of $150,000 on how much families can earn and still qualify for vouchers for their children. Next item, teachers' unions. Also sent to the ballot by the legislature is another measure affecting the Arizona Education Association. If approved, it would prohibit a school district from using any resources to support the operation of a labor organization. That includes distributing union information or political materials through the school's internal communication system. It also would end the ability of the union members to have their AEA dues deducted from their school paychecks. And teachers could not take paid leave for labor activities. Backus said there is no reason for public dollars to be used to subsidize the union. The next front page article is titled, Arizona to Buy California Water. This article was written by Tony Davis, Arizona of the Arizona Daily Star. Under a landmark agreement, Arizona is negotiating to buy Colorado River water, now owned by a San Diego area agency, and experts say the first of that water could be headed to the state in 4 to 6 months. The goal of the new agreement, signed by federal officials and leaders of water agencies in Arizona, California, and Nevada, is to eventually transfer potentially large amounts of Colorado River water between states. The first step is to negotiate how actual sales would be consummated legally and financially. The plan is to start small with a pilot program. At first, it would transfer maybe one-tenth of the amount of Tucson's annual drinking water demand from the San Diego County Water Authority to Arizona, Nevada, or other water agencies in Southern California, then ramp up the transfers by up to 10 times as much or more. The purpose of these sales would be twofold, backers say. One is to bring what one expert calls a buffer to Arizona and other western states facing a very real possibility of losing substantial amounts of their Colorado River supplies in the next few years due to continuing extreme drought and a changing climate. This year, the river is slated to carry a slow spring-summer runoff into Lake Powell on record due to a record-low winter snowpack and record-setting warm spring temperatures. That comes as the 7 Colorado River Basin states have tried with no success to negotiate a long-term agreement to manage the river, forcing the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to come up with its own, almost certainly unpopular fix. The second purpose from San Diego's viewpoint would be to take some financial pressure off the water authorities, which a decade ago built and has since operated a hugely expensive desalination plant in the coastal city of Carlsbad, north of San Diego. It costs almost 10 times as much to produce its desalted water as the agency running the Central Arizona Project pays to pump its share of Colorado River water uphill from the river to Phoenix and Tucson. One result is that water demand in the San Diego area has plummeted by as much as 50% in per-person use since the 1990s. The San Diego County Authority has said. Another is that the desalination plant and construction of other new water facilities have triggered major water rate increases in the area to the point where the San Diego area has some of the highest water rates in any U.S. metro area. The plant also at times runs well below its operating capacity of 50,000 acre feet a year, averaging about 40,000 acre feet over time, but at times running as low as 25% to 33% of total capacity. The utility's hope is that selling off some of its river water will raise enough revenue to pay off much of the debt that is incurred to build the desal plant and other facilities. Those cost disparities will set the stage for potentially divisive negotiations between Arizona and the San Diego Water Agency over how much the state would pay the water authority for its water. The San Diego agency would not be selling the desalted water directly to Arizona or other states. It would be allowing some of its river water supplies to stay in the river. These water supplies would be placed into the 336-mile-long concrete canal used by the CAP, but the agency would want to charge enough for the water it does sell to help reduce some of its debt and cover some of the desal plant's costs. Nobody at this point can say how much Arizona will pay for San Diego's share of river water, but the San Diego Authority's general manager, Dan Denham, said Arizona will have to pay more than the $365 an acre foot it now pays for delivering cap water. Cap Board President Terry Garden, however, said selling river water to Arizona at the $3,500 an acre foot it costs to run the desal plant is unacceptable. The plan, as outlined by Denham, would be to start by transplanting maybe 10,000 acre feet a year. Over time, authority officials hope to expand the amount of water sold, first to 25,000, then to 50,000, and ultimately more than 100,000 acre feet a year, said Denham. The 100,000 acre feet is about how much drinking water Tucsonans consume annually. How much the authority will sell really depends on the duration of the deal, Denham said. One thing the Water Authority is not necessarily interested in doing is to sell a one-time slug of water, he said. The Colorado River Basin is in bad shape. What we want is a long-term contract for larger volumes of water. As for the timing of a first-year deal, depending on how quickly the lawyers work, it could be 4 to 6 months before the first water from San Diego comes to Arizona, said David Wegner, a former Bureau of Reclamation official who remains active in water issues. Arizona State University water researcher Sarah Porter agrees that the parties to the negotiations could jump through all the legal and administration hoops quickly. CAP officials, for instance, have already agreed on a program to allow other agencies' water supplies to flow into their canal. After years of discussion and haggling over how to deal with water quality from outside sources. And because the entire Colorado River Basin is in an urgent situation, I expect people would find ways of getting through the process as quick, as fast as possible, said Porter, director of ASU's Kyle Center for Water Policy. Goddard is less certain about the region's ability to draft and put into effect an agreement in 6 months. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading by the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The title of the first article is Wrongful Conviction Fund Gets No New Money. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Just a year ago, state lawmakers and Governor Katie Hobbs agreed that people who are wrongfully convicted deserve some compensation from the state. Now that program is gone. Strictly speaking, a provision tucked into the new state budget does not repeal the 2025 law that established the state's first ever erroneous conviction fund. Instead, it says the only money that can be made available to anyone who qualifies must come from that fund and nowhere else. The problem, $3 million put into the fund last year is gone or already spoken for. In fact, the 11 people who were the first to apply already have put in requests for more than the $3 million in the fund. Arizona's new budget puts no more dollars into the account. So for all intents and purposes, it's broke. All that left Representative Kyle Powell not to get unanimous support for the plan a year ago bitter. The Gilbert Republican reminded colleagues that the whole purpose of the fund was to provide some financial relief for people whose lives were destroyed and people who were pardoned because they were put in prison illegally, they were put in prison innocently. Powell said that it's important for lawmakers to get their priorities straight. We just voted on a bill to give $500,000 for helping those who have problems with gambling, he said. Yet we cannot find monies to help somebody whose lives have been destroyed, Powell said. To me, it's incomprehensible. But State Majority Leader John Kavanaugh said it was never the intent of lawmakers to put more money into the account. The Fountain Hills Republican said it was meant only to provide seed money to allow people to start to seek recovery without having to go to court. But he said that any harm to people who are wrongfully convicted and incarcerated is not the state's fault. We're paying off wrongs committed by county prosecutors, Kavanaugh said. The counties are responsible for compensating them. But that leaves those affected with only the portion of having to file suit, something that Powell said creation of the fund and its expected review was designed to avoid. As approved last year, the measure entitles those who were ultimately released after being found to be factually innocent to seek financial relief equal to twice the median income for each of the 12 years he was locked up. But the measure does more than simply write out the check. It also provides counseling and job training. And it even precluded the state from seeking to reduce the payments by what was paid to house and feed him. It wasn't just Powell's argument that helped put Arizona among the more than three dozen states that have enacted similar programs. During hearings last year, lawmakers heard from those whose lives were changed by wrongful convictions. That included Drayton Witt, who said he was stabbed 73 times and nearly killed while imprisoned by the state in Winslow. Witt had been convicted in a 2002 second-degree murder after being accused of shaking his nearly 5-month-old baby to death. But he was released after the county medical examiner re-examined the evidence and concluded that the death was a result of the child's medical history and neurological problems. Witt told lawmakers last year that he started a small painting company since being freed in 2012, but he said it hasn't been easy to rebuild his life. I would lose numerous jobs on a daily basis just simply from a Google search, which turned up his conviction, Witt said. Still, he said, it's not simply about compensation. It's more about integrity, holding people accountable, Witt continued. At one point in time, I voted for somebody to be put in a position of power to look out for my best interests, he said. And instead, those people sent me up the river to die. Since its inception, the program has gotten the attention of several individuals. As for February, the most recent data available, 11 individuals wrongfully convicted of crimes have applied for millions of dollars in compensation from the state, swamping a state fund that has only $3 million. In some ways, that was expected as the legislation was crafted to be retroactive, affecting not just new cases, but those going back years. Legislative analysts had said there have been 24 exonerations in Arizona since 1989, with an average time behind bars of 5.6 years. Assuming just 20% of those exonerated in that time period submit claims, that's penciled out to a one-time cost of $4.5 million. But that report also concluded that based on historical averages, the annual cost going forward would be in the neighborhood of about $641,000. What drives that cost goes beyond that 200% of median household income for each year incarcerated. The bill also allows individuals to get reasonable attorney fees and costs up to $25,000 and up to $100,000 for reintegrative services and mental and physical health care costs involved between the time of release and the entry of a court judgment. The law also concludes up to 52 hours of mental health treatment with 12 months of a court order at a rate of $250 an hour. There's also up to 120 credit hours at any college, vocational school, or state school. Powell, in pushing the bill last year, said that in particular is justified. Their absence of being in the community for 15 or 20 years may have injured their ability to provide for themselves, he said, so now they need additional training. And the bill provides for up to 4 financial planning or literacy classes within the first year. We provide these outlets for them to be fully restituted and be able to recover so that they can become a productive member of society, Powell said. All that leads back to Powell this year proposing legislation to put another $3 million a year into the fund at least through 2027. Not only did this bill never get a hearing, but then his colleagues through the budget process decided there would be no more cash. Powell decried that decision on Thursday. We need to help people whose lives have been destroyed because we destroyed it through our criminal justice system, he told colleagues. Representative Alexander Kolodin agreed, it's a travesty that we have messed with what I view as one of the greatest achievements during my time in the legislature, said the Scottsdale Republican. And he pointed out that Powell pushed through the provision for his first year as a representative, which is no small feat. But Golden said the provision gutting the fund is only one part of the overall budget, which he supports. So, unlike Powell, he ended up voting for the measure. The title of the next article is JTED Bond Plan to Expand Tech Education. This article was written by Sierra Blazer of the Arizona Daily Star. Voters in southern Arizona could decide whether to invest $250 million in expanding career and technical education programs through a proposed JTED bond this November. The proposed bond, called for during Tuesday's governing board meeting, would fund major expansions and upgrades to Pima County Joint Technical Education District's JTED CTE facilities across the region. These include a new building at JTED Central Campus, remodeled classrooms, and expanded workforce training programs, according to JTED Director of Public Relations Greg Deanna. About $186 million would go toward JTED Central Campus, while the rest would be allocated to some of its programs at satellite schools. Voters in Pima and Santa Cruz counties will have deciding power. If approved, the bond would cost taxpayers about $14 annually for every $100,000 of assessed property value. The bond would remain in effect for 15 years. The Tucson Unified School District Governing Board approved a slate of interim leadership appointments, including a new interim director of grants and federal programs and 4 new interim assistant principals. Daniel Sanchez was appointed interim director of grants and federal programs following the move of former director John Lanza into an interim regional assistant superintendent role. The board also approved unanimously 4 interim assistants principal appointments. Teenage Parent High School and Project Moore, Amber Paris, Bistro Middle School, Eleuterio Cortez, Valencia Middle School, Alexis Smith, or Clark rather, and Hollinger K-8, Marco Dominguez. The next article is titled TPD Lands Drone Program. This article was written by Sarah Lapidus of the Arizona Republic. Tucson leaders approved a police drone program designed to speed emergency response with no pushback from local groups or council members who are typically critical of how drones or public safety technology are used. The Tucson Police Department plans to implement an aerial emergency response year-long pilot program aimed at improving response times to calls and improving safety for first responders and the community. Tucson Police Chief Monica Prieto said in a June 9th public meeting the drones can arrive on scene within 2 or 3 minutes, a faster response time than ground units 91% of the time. Aerial information helps first responders before they arrive on scene, she said. Early information helps identify hazards, supports de-escalation, and enhances respondent safety and decision-making, Prieto said. She pointed to the benefit of drones, which help police locate missing people, fleeing suspects, and people in crisis. Tucson Police already uses a range of tech tools, including a technology hub called the Community Safety and Response Center, automated license plate readers, video surveillance, body-worn cameras, and line-of-sight drones. Prieto said drones have already helped during criminal investigations. She pointed to an incident during which a police used drones to locate and arrest a homicide suspect and recover evidence during an active homicide scene. Other communities also use drones as first responders, like Oro Valley, a municipality north of Tucson. The town leased flock safety drones in February in the hopes of improving how police respond to calls. The aerial emergency response pilot program will use SkyDio drones at 4 locations with 2 dogs at each station. The program will test whether fast aerial awareness can improve first responders' response time and safety. The use of the drones will only be used for calls of service or investigations. That's according to Luis Romero, a technology administrator with the Tucson Police. The pilot program seeks to measure numerous data points like launch to arrival, user and community feedback, usable time on scene, privacy compliance, and more. Based on 2025 data and modeling, SkyDio drones are expected to cover 66,917 public safety calls between both Tucson police and fire departments, with an average response time in the coverage area of roughly 2.23 minutes. SkyDio is integrated with Exxon, a public safety technology company criticized for its contract with the Department of Homeland Security. Councilmember Miranda Schubert noted SkyDio's partnership with Exxon. She raised concerns about the company's ongoing contract with immigration officials and asked police to explain more about how the data is kept. Romero said data from the drones will be stored in a private cloud used solely by the Tucson Police Department. She noted that only authorized users and administrators will be able to access the system. These are not shared ecosystems. This is its own separate cloud-based technology that is only associated as a private company cloud for the city of Tucson, specifically the Tucson Police Department, Romero said. Data from these deployments will be kept for 185 days, he said, the same as other record-keeping for non-evidentiary recordings. Romero said use of the drone systems will be audited quarterly to ensure compliance. The aerial emergency response pilot will go through oversight of various groups after 6 months, including a new group, the Unmanned Aerial Systems Governance Group, and a community oversight group, the Independent Audit and Performance Commission, among others. The department said it doesn't share data with other agencies unless there is an approved intergovernmental agreement or memorandum of understanding, an authorized use case, and a documented auditable process. The Tucson Police website indicates the agency does not have an agreement or memorandum of understanding to provide data for immigration enforcement or removal operations. The department does share case information and evidence on large cases with partner agencies at the local, state, federal, and tribal levels. The use of technology is part of Tucson's Safe City Initiative, a program that coordinates efforts to improve safety across the city. The initiative also includes a transit safety and security action plan that outlines efforts to protect bus drivers and riders. The Tucson City Council discussed on June 9th how to allocate $2.15 million annually, or $43 million over 20 years of transit safety activities. The funding comes from the Pima County Regional Transportation Authorities, paid for by a half-cent sales tax. Tucson's portion of the funding comes from a $51 million pool of funds allocated for transit safety projects across Pima County. The plan includes deploying transit ambassadors and outreach teams, sending police to patrol high-priority areas, increasing contracted security guards, and developing an operator safety improvement plan. The draft budget also includes funding for cameras, barrier improvements for the operators, repeat offender tracking, and more. The plan was developed with input from city departments, transit company, SunTrans representatives, labor partners, and community representatives. Schubert criticized parts of the transit safety plan that allocates funds to track repeat offenders. "We don't have a clear policy right now for drivers and operators to prevent those people from getting on. We also don't have clear expulsion policy yet," she said. "These are low-hanging fruit and basic features of making a safe transit system." She also pushed back on paying for public transit, which another council member brought up at the meeting. She said that the repeat offenders are just a small percentage of transit riders, and that 70% of the people who ride the bus are low income. "These are not shared ecosystems. This is on its own separate cloud-based technology that is only associated as our own private cloud for the city of Tucson, specifically the Tucson Police Department." Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the June 15th, 2026 edition of the Arizona Daily Star. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.